Chapter 6. Faith. It's a truism that we Americans are religious people. According to the most recent surveys, 95% of Americans believe in God. 68% belong to a church, synagogue, or mosque. 37% call themselves committed Christians. And substantially more people believe in angels than do those who believe in evolution. Nor is religion confined to places of worship. Books proclaiming the end of days sell millions of copies, Christian music fills the Billboard charts, and new megachurches seem to spring up daily on the outskirts of every major metropolis, providing everything from daycare to singles mixers to yoga and Pilates classes. Our president routinely remarks on how Christ changed his heart, and football players point to the heavens after every touchdown, as if God were calling plays from the celestial sidelines. Of course, such religiosity is hardly new. The pilgrims came to our shores to escape religious persecution and practice without impediment their brand of strict Calvinism. Evangelical revivalism has repeatedly swept across the nation, and waves of successive immigrants have used their faith to anchor their lives in a strange new world. Religious sentiment and religious activism have sparked some of our most powerful political movements, from abolition to civil rights, to the prairie populism of William Jennings Bryan. Still, if 50 years ago you had asked the most prominent cultural commentators of the time just what the future of religion in America might be, they would have undoubtedly told you it was on the decline. The old-time religion was withering away, it was argued, a victim of science, higher levels of education in the general population, and the marvels of technology. Respectable folks might still attend church every Sunday, Bible thumpers and faith healers might still work the Southern revival circuit. The fear of godless communism might help feed McCarthyism and the Red Scare. But for the most part, traditional religious practice, and certainly religious fundamentalism, was considered incompatible with modernity. At most, a refuge of the poor and uneducated from the hardships of life. Even Billy Graham's monumental crusades were treated as curious anachronisms by pundits and academics. Vestiges of an earlier time that had little to do with the serious work of managing a modern economy or shaping foreign policy. By the time the 60s rolled around, many mainstream Protestant and Catholic leaders had concluded that if America's religious institutions were to survive, they would have to make themselves relevant to changing times by accommodating church doctrine to science and articulating a social gospel that addressed the material issues of economic inequality, racism, sexism, and American militarism. What happened? In part, the cooling of religious enthusiasm among Americans was always exaggerated. On this score, at least, the conservative critique of liberal elitism has a strong measure of truth. Ensconced in universities and large urban centers, academics, journalists, and purveyors of popular culture simply failed to appreciate the continuing role that all manner of religious expression played in communities across the country. Indeed, the failure of the country's dominant cultural institutions to acknowledge America's religious impulse helped foster a degree of religious entrepreneurship unmatched anywhere in the industrialized world. Pushed out of sight, but still throbbing with vitality throughout the heartland and the Bible Belt, a parallel universe emerged, a world not only of revivals and thriving ministries, but also Christian television, radio, universities, publishers, and entertainment, all of which allowed the devout to ignore the popular culture as surely as they were being ignored. The reluctance on the part of many evangelicals to be drawn into politics, their inward focus on individual salvation and willingness to render unto Caesar what was his, might have endured indefinitely had it not been for the social upheavals of the 60s. In the minds of some Southern Christians, the decision of a distant federal court to dismantle segregation seemed of a piece with its decision to eliminate prayer in schools, a multi-pronged assault on the pillars of traditional Southern life. Across America, the women's movement, the sexual revolution, the increasing assertiveness of gays and lesbians, and most powerfully, the Supreme Court's decision in Roe v. Wade, seemed a direct challenge to the church's teachings about marriage, sexuality, and the proper roles of men and women. Feeling mocked and under attack, conservative Christians found it no longer possible to insulate themselves from the country's broader political and cultural trends. And although it was Jimmy Carter who had first introduced the language of evangelical Christianity into modern national politics, it was the Republican Party, with its increasing emphasis on tradition, order, and family values, that was best positioned to harvest this crop of politically awakened evangelicals and mobilize them against the liberal orthodoxy. The story of how Ronald Reagan, Jerry Falwell, Pat Robertson, Ralph Reed, and finally Karl Rove and George W. Bush mobilized this army of Christian foot soldiers need not be repeated here. Suffice to say that today, white evangelical Christians, along with conservative Catholics, are the heart and soul of the Republican Party's grassroots base, a core following continually mobilized by a network of pulpits and media outlets that technology has only amplified. It is their issues, abortion, gay marriage, prayer in schools, intelligent design, Terri Schiavo, the posting of the Ten Commandments in the courthouse, homeschooling, voucher plans, and the makeup of the Supreme Court that often dominate the headlines and serve as one of the major fault lines in American politics. The single biggest gap in party affiliation among white Americans is not between men and women, or those who reside in so-called red states and those who reside in blue, but between those who attend religious services regularly and those who don't. Democrats, meanwhile, are scrambling to get religion, even as a core segment of our constituency remains stubbornly secular in its orientation, and fears, rightly no doubt, that the agenda of an assertively Christian nation may not make room for them or their life choices. But the growing political influence of the Christian right tells only part of the story. The moral majority in the Christian coalition may have tapped into the discontent of many evangelical Christians. But what is more remarkable is the ability of evangelical Christianity not only to survive, but to thrive in modern high-tech America. At a time when mainline Protestant churches are losing membership at a rapid clip, non-denominational evangelical churches are growing in leaps and bounds, eliciting levels of commitment and participation from their membership that no other American institution can match. Their fervor has gone mainstream. There are various explanations for this success, from the skill of evangelicals in marketing religion to the charisma of their leaders. But their success also points to a hunger for the product they are selling, a hunger that goes beyond any particular issue or cause. Each day, it seems, thousands of Americans are going about their daily round, dropping off the kids at school, driving to the office, flying to a business meeting, shopping at the mall, trying to stay on their diets, and coming to the realization that something's missing. They're deciding that their work, their possessions, their diversions, their sheer busyness is not enough. They want a sense of purpose, a narrative arc to their lives, something that will relieve a chronic loneliness or lift them above the exhausting, relentless toll of daily life. They need an assurance that somebody out there cares about them, is listening to them, that they are not just destined to travel down a long highway towards nothingness. If I have any insight into this movement toward a deepening religious commitment, perhaps it's because it's a road I have traveled. I was not raised in a religious household. For my mother, organized religion too often dressed up closed-mindedness in the garb of piety, cruelty and oppression in the cloak of righteousness. This isn't to say that she provided me with no religious instruction. In her mind, a working knowledge of the world's great religions was a necessary part of any well-rounded education. In our household, the Bible, the Quran, and the Bhagavad Gita sat on the shelf alongside books of Greek and Norse and African mythology. On Easter or Christmas Day, my mother might drag me to church, just as she dragged me to the Buddhist temple, the Chinese New Year celebration, the Shinto shrine, and ancient Hawaiian burial sites. But I was made to understand that such religious samplings required no sustained commitment on my part, no introspective exertion or self-flagellation. Religion was an expression of human culture, she would explain, not its wellspring, just one of the many ways, and not necessarily the best way, that man attempted to control the unknowable and understand the deeper truths about our lives. In sum, my mother viewed religion through the eyes of the anthropologist that she would become. It was a phenomenon to be treated with a suitable respect, but with a suitable detachment as well. My mother was less concerned with me learning the catechism, or puzzling out the meaning of the muezzin's call to evening prayer, than she was with whether I was properly learning my multiplication tables. And yet, for all her professed secularism, my mother was in many ways the most spiritually awakened person that I've ever known. She had an unswerving instinct for kindness, charity, and love, and spent much of her life acting on that instinct, sometimes to her detriment. Without the help of religious texts or outside authorities, she worked mightily to instill in me the values that many Americans learn in Sunday school: honesty, empathy, discipline, delayed gratification, and hard work. She raged at poverty and injustice, and scorned those who were indifferent to both. Most of all, she possessed an abiding sense of wonder, a reverence for life and its precious transitory nature that could properly be described as devotional. She saw mysteries everywhere and took joy in the sheer strangeness of life. It's only in retrospect, of course, that I fully understand how deeply this spirit of hers influenced me, how it sustained me despite the absence of a father in the house, how it buoyed me through the rocky shoals of my adolescence, and how it invisibly guided the path I would ultimately take. I've recorded in a previous book the ways in which my early work in Chicago helped me grow into my manhood, how my work with the pastors and laypeople there deepened my resolve to lead a public life, how they fortified my racial identity and confirmed my belief in the capacity of ordinary people to do extraordinary things. But my experiences in Chicago also forced me to confront a dilemma that my mother never fully resolved in her own life: the fact that I had no community or shared traditions in which to ground my deepest held beliefs. The Christians with whom I worked recognized themselves in me. They saw that I knew their book and shared their values and sang their songs. But they sensed that a part of me remained removed, detached, an observer among them. I came to realize that without a vessel for my beliefs, without an unequivocal commitment to a particular community of faith, I would be consigned at some level to always remain apart, free in the way that my mother was free, but also alone in the same ways she was ultimately alone. There are worse things than such freedom. My mother would live happily as a citizen of the world, stitching together a community of friends wherever she found herself, satisfying her need for meaning in her work and in her children. In such a life, I too might have contented myself, had it not been for the particular attributes of the historically black church, attributes that helped me shed some of my skepticism and embrace the Christian faith. For one thing, I was drawn to the power of the African-American religious tradition to spur social change. Out of necessity, the black church had to minister to the whole man. Out of necessity, the black church rarely had the luxury of separating individual salvation from collective salvation. It had had to serve as the center of the community's political, economic, and social as well as spiritual life. It understood in an intimate way the biblical call to feed the hungry and clothe the naked and challenge powers and principalities. In the history of these struggles, I was able to see faith as more than just a comfort to the weary or a hedge against death, but rather as an active, palpable agent in the world. In the day-to-day work of the men and women I met in church each day, in their ability to make a way out of no way and maintain hope and dignity in the direst of circumstances, I could see the Word made manifest. And perhaps it was out of this intimate knowledge of hardship, the grounding of faith and struggle, that the historically black church offered me a second insight: that faith doesn't mean that you don't have doubts or that you relinquish your hold on this world. It was because of these newfound understandings that religious commitment did not require me to suspend critical thinking, disengage from the battle for economic and social justice, or otherwise retreat from the world that I knew and loved, that I was able finally to walk down the aisle of Trinity United Church of Christ one day and be baptized for the first time. It came about as a choice, not an epiphany. The questions I had did not magically disappear. But kneeling beneath that cross on the south side of Chicago, I felt I heard God's Spirit beckoning me. I submitted myself to His will and dedicated myself to discovering His truth. Liberalism teaches us to be tolerant of other people's religious beliefs, so long as those beliefs don't cause anyone harm or impinge on another's right to believe differently. To the extent that religious communities are content to keep to themselves, and faith is neatly confined as a matter of individual conscience, such tolerance is not tested. But religion is rarely practiced in isolation. Organized religion, at least, is a very public affair. The faithful may feel compelled by their religion to actively evangelize wherever they can. They may feel that a secular state promotes values that directly offend their beliefs. They may want the larger society to validate and reinforce their views. And when the religiously motivated assert themselves politically to achieve these aims, liberals get nervous. Those of us in public office may try to avoid the conversation about religious values altogether, fearful of offending anyone and claiming that, regardless of our personal beliefs, constitutional principles tie our hands on issues like abortion or school prayer. Some on the left, although not those in public office, go further, dismissing religion in the public square as inherently irrational, intolerant, and therefore dangerous, and noting that, with its emphasis on personal salvation and the policing of private morality, religious talk has given conservatives cover to ignore questions of public morality, like poverty or corporate malfeasance. Such strategies of avoidance may work for progressives at times, but over the long haul, I think we make a mistake when we fail to acknowledge the power of faith in the lives of the American people, and so avoid joining a serious debate about how to reconcile faith with our modern pluralistic democracy. To begin with, it's bad politics. There are a whole lot of religious people in America, including the majority of Democrats. When we abandon the field of religious discourse, when we ignore the debate about what it means to be a good Christian or Muslim or Jew, when we discuss religion only in the negative sense of where or how it should not be practiced, rather than in the positive sense of what it tells us about our obligations towards one another, when we shy away from religious venues and religious broadcasts because we assume that we will be unwelcome, others will fill the vacuum. And those who do are likely to be those with the most insular views of faith, or who cynically use religion to justify partisan ends. More fundamentally, the discomfort of some progressives with any hint of religiosity has often inhibited us from effectively addressing issues in moral terms. Some of the problem is rhetorical. Scrub language of all religious content, and we forfeit the imagery and terminology through which millions of Americans understand both their personal morality and social justice. I'm not suggesting that every progressive suddenly latch on to religious terminology, or that we abandon the fight for institutional change in favor of 1,000 points of light. I am suggesting that if we progressives shed some of our own biases, we might recognize the values that both religious and secular people share when it comes to the moral and material direction of our country. We need to take faith seriously, not simply to block the religious right, but to engage all persons of faith in the larger project of American renewal. To do this, the tensions and suspicions on each side of the religious divide will have to be squarely addressed, and each side will need to accept some ground rules for collaboration. The first and most difficult step for some evangelical Christians is to acknowledge the critical role that the Establishment Clause has played in not only the development of our democracy, but also in the robustness of our religious practice. Contrary to the claims of many on the Christian right who rail against the separation of church and state, their argument is not with a handful of liberal 60s judges. It's with the drafters of the Bill of Rights and the forebearers of today's evangelical church. Many of the leading lights of the Revolution, most notably Franklin and Jefferson, were deists who, while believing in an almighty God, questioned not only the dogmas of the Christian church, but the central tenets of Christianity itself, including Christ's divinity. Jefferson and Madison in particular argued for what Jefferson called a wall of separation between church and state, as a means of protecting individual liberty and religious belief and practice, protecting the state from sectarian strife, and protecting organized religion from the state's encroachment or undue influence. Of course, not all founding fathers agreed. Men like Patrick Henry and John Adams forwarded a variety of proposals to use the arm of the state to promote religion. But while it was Jefferson and Madison who pushed through the Virginia Statute of Religious Freedom that would become the model for the First Amendment's religion clauses, it wasn't these students of the Enlightenment who proved to be the most effective champions of a separation between church and state. Rather, it was Baptists like Reverend John Leland and other evangelicals who provided the popular support needed to get these provisions ratified. They did so because they were outsiders, because their style of exuberant worship appealed to the lower classes, because their evangelization of all comers, including slaves, threatened the established order, because they were no respecter of rank and privilege, and because they were consistently persecuted and disdained by the dominant Anglican Church in the South and Congregationalist orders of the North. Not only did they rightly fear that any state-sponsored religion might encroach on their ability as religious minorities to practice their faith, they also believed that religious vitality inevitably withers when compelled or supported by the state. Jefferson and Leland's formula for religious freedom worked. Not only has America avoided the sort of religious strife that continues to plague the globe, but religious institutions have continued to thrive, a robustness of religious practice that some observers attribute directly to the absence of a state-sponsored church, and hence a premium on religious experimentation and voluntarism. Moreover, given the increasing diversity of America's population, the dangers of sectarianism have never been greater. Whatever we once were, we are no longer just a Christian nation. We are also a Jewish nation, a Muslim nation, a Buddhist nation, a Hindu nation, and a nation of non-believers. But let's even assume that we only had Christians within our borders. Whose Christianity would we teach in the schools? James Dobson's or Al Sharpton's? Which passages of Scripture should guide our public policy? Should we go with Leviticus, which suggests that slavery is all right and eating shellfish is an abomination? How about Deuteronomy, which suggests stoning your child if he strays from the faith? Or should we just stick to the Sermon on the Mount, a passage so radical that it's doubtful our Defense Department would survive its application? This brings us to a different point, the manner in which religious views should inform public debate and guide elected officials. Surely secularists are wrong when they ask believers to leave their religion at the door before entering the public square. Frederick Douglass, Abraham Lincoln, William Jennings Bryan, Dorothy Day, Martin Luther King, indeed the majority of great reformers in American history, were not only motivated by faith, but repeatedly used religious language to argue their causes. To say that men and women should not inject their personal morality into public policy debates is a practical absurdity. Our law is by definition a codification of morality, much of it grounded in the Judeo-Christian tradition. What our deliberative, pluralistic democracy does demand is that the religiously motivated translate their concerns into universal rather than religious-specific values. It requires that their proposals must be subject to argument and amenable to reason. If I am opposed to abortion for religious reasons and seek to pass a law banning the practice, I cannot simply point to the teachings of my church or invoke God's will and expect that argument to carry the day. If I want others to listen to me, then I have to explain why abortion violates some principle that is accessible to people of all faiths, including those with no faith at all. For those who believe in the inerrancy of the Bible, as many evangelicals do, such rules of engagement may seem just one more example of the tyranny of the secular and material worlds over the sacred and eternal. But in a pluralistic democracy, we have no choice. Almost by definition, faith and reason operate in different domains and involve different paths to discerning truth. Reason, and science, involves the accumulation of knowledge based on realities that we can all apprehend. Religion, by contrast, is based on truths that are not provable through ordinary human understanding, the belief in things not seen. When science teachers insist on keeping creationism or intelligent design out of their classrooms, they are not asserting that scientific knowledge is superior to religious insight. They are simply insisting that each path to knowledge involves different rules, and that those rules are not interchangeable. In a pluralistic democracy, the same distinctions apply. Politics, like science, depends on our ability to persuade each other of common aims based on a common reality. Moreover, politics, unlike science, involves compromise, the art of the possible. At some fundamental level, religion does not allow for compromise. It insists on the impossible. If God has spoken, then followers are expected to live up to God's edicts, regardless of the consequences. To base one's life on such uncompromising commitments may be sublime. To base our policy making on such commitments would be a dangerous thing. The story of Abraham and Isaac offers a simple but powerful example. According to the world's three great monotheistic religions, Abraham is ordered by God to offer up his only son Isaac, whom you love, as a burnt offering. Without argument, Abraham takes Isaac to the mountaintop, binds him to an altar, and raises his knife, prepared to act as God has commanded. Of course, we know the happy ending. God sends down an angel to intercede at the very last minute. Abraham has passed God's test of devotion. He becomes a model of fidelity to God, and his great faith is rewarded through future generations. And yet it is fair to say that if any of us saw a 21st century Abraham raising the knife on the roof of his apartment building, we would call the police. We would wrestle him down. Even if we saw him lower the knife at the last minute, we would expect the Department of Children and Family Services to take Isaac away and charge Abraham with child abuse. We would do so because God doesn't reveal himself or his angels to all of us in a single moment. We do not hear what Abraham hears, do not see what Abraham sees, true as those experiences may be. So the best we can do is act in accordance with those things that are possible for all of us to know, understanding that a part of what we know to be true as individuals or communities of faith will be true for us alone. Finally, any reconciliation between faith and democratic pluralism requires some sense of proportion. This is not entirely foreign to religious doctrine. Even those who claim the Bible's inerrancy make distinctions between scriptural edicts, based on a sense that some passages, the Ten Commandments say, or a belief in Christ's divinity, are central to Christian faith, while others are more culturally specific and may be modified to accommodate modern life. The American people intuitively understand this, which is why the majority of Catholics practice birth control, and some of those who oppose gay marriage nevertheless are opposed to a constitutional amendment banning it. Religious leadership need not accept such wisdom in counseling their flocks, but they should recognize this wisdom in their politics. If a sense of proportion should guide Christian activism, then it must also guide those who police the boundaries between church and state. Not every mention of God in public is a breach of the wall of separation. As the Supreme Court has properly recognized, context matters. It is doubtful that children reciting the Pledge of Allegiance feel oppressed or brainwashed as a consequence of muttering the phrase, "under God." I didn't. Allowing the use of school property for meetings by voluntary student prayer groups should not be a threat, any more than its use by the high school Republicans should threaten Democrats. And one can envision certain faith-based programs targeting ex-offenders or substance abusers that offer a uniquely powerful way of solving problems and hence merit carefully tailored support. There are some things that I'm absolutely sure about. The golden rule, the need to battle cruelty in all its forms, the value of love and charity, humility and grace. Those beliefs were driven home 2 years ago when I flew down to Birmingham, Alabama to deliver a speech at the city's Civil Rights Institute. The institute is right across the street from 16th Street Baptist Church, the site where, in 1963, four young children, Addie Mae Collins, Carol Robertson, Cynthia Wesley, and Denise McNair, lost their lives when a bomb planted by white supremacists exploded during Sunday school. Before my talk, I took an opportunity to visit the church. The young pastor and several deacons greeted me at the door and showed me the still visible scar along the wall where the bomb went off. I saw the clock at the back of the church, still frozen at 10:22 a.m. I studied the portraits of the four little girls. After the tour, the pastor, deacons, and I held hands and said a prayer in the sanctuary. Then they left me to sit in one of the pews and gather my thoughts. What must it have been like for those parents 40 years ago, I wondered. knowing that their precious daughters had been snatched away by violence, at once so casual and so vicious. How could one endure the anguish unless one was certain that some purpose lay behind their murders, some meaning in immeasurable loss? Those parents would have seen the mourners pour in from all across the nation, would have read the condolences from across the globe, would have watched as Lyndon Johnson announced on national television that the time had come to overcome, would have seen Congress finally pass the Civil Rights Act of 1964. Friends and strangers alike would have assured them that their daughters had not died in vain, that they had awakened the conscience of a nation and helped liberate a people, that the bomb had burst a dam to let justice roll down like water and righteousness like a mighty stream. And yet would even that knowledge be enough to console your grief, to keep you from madness and eternal rage, unless you also knew that your child had gone on to a better place? My thoughts turned to my mother and her final days, after cancer had spread throughout her body, and it was clear that there was no coming back. She had admitted to me during the course of her illness that she was not ready to die. The suddenness of it all had taken her by surprise, as if the physical world she loved so much had turned on her, betrayed her. And although she fought valiantly, endured the pain and chemotherapy with grace and good humor to the very end, more than once I saw fear flash across her eyes. More than fear of pain or fear of the unknown, it was the sheer loneliness of death that would have frightened her, I think. The notion that on this final journey, on this last adventure, she would have no one to fully share her experiences with. No one who could marvel with her at the body's capacity to inflict pain on itself. Her laugh at the stark absurdity of life once one's hair starts falling out and one's saliva glands shut down. I carried such thoughts with me as I left the church and made my speech. Later that night, back home in Chicago, I sat at the dinner table watching Malia and Sasha as they laughed and bickered and resisted their string beans before their mother chased them up the stairs and to their baths. Alone in the kitchen, washing the dishes, I imagined my two girls growing up and felt the ache that every parent must feel at one time or another, that desire to snatch up each moment of your child's presence and never let go, to preserve every gesture, to lock in for all eternity the sight of their curls or the feel of their fingers clasped around yours. I thought of Sasha asking me once what happened when we die. "I don't want to die, Daddy," she had added matter-of-factly, and I'd hugged her and said, "You've got a long, long way to go before you have to worry about that," which had seemed to satisfy her. I wondered whether I should have told her the truth, that I wasn't sure what happens when we die, any more than I was sure of where the soul resides or what existed before the Big Bang. Walking up the stairs, though, I knew what I hoped for, that my mother was somewhere, together in some way with those four little girls, capable in some fashion of embracing them, of finding joy in their spirits. I know that tucking in my daughters that night, I grasped a little bit of heaven.